From KQED Public Radio and the California Report, this is the Capital Notes podcast for May 6th, day after Cinco de Mayo.
It's the Seis de Mayo.
You know, before we had kids, we could have made some joke about how you're feeling today. Are you hungover? Did you have too much partying? And now, not so much.
I just don't understand that if we had a party every time somebody had a military victory against the French, we would just be partying constantly.
And with that, our transition. That's Anthony York from the Los Angeles Times. I'm John Myers from KQED. We weren't here last week. Anthony was sick.
It wasn't pretty.
You want to talk about that stomach bug? No, let's not do that.
Let's not.
Let's not.
We'll post photos on the website.
What's less pretty, that or the state budget?
Segue.
Well, that's clearly the weakest segue I could have come up with.
Well, this week, I think, you know, there was some good news in the budget.
Well,
right?
there was a little bit, though it's been...
though the Brown administration says no, absolutely no good news.
We are
news.
Being told to temper our enthusiasm. To not
curb our enthusiasm.
Pop the champagne corks. Curb our enthusiasm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
An HBO reference. So let's backtrack a little bit here, rolling back the clock, as it were, for things that we did or didn't do. Let's mention briefly, just to be chronological, that the California State Democratic Party had its convention here in Sactown last weekend. And there wasn't any big news. There wasn't going to be any big news. There really wasn't any big news, but there wasn't going to be much of even, I think, of a big wrinkle at one point. Though I think a lot of us were waiting to see Governor Brown make his pitch for his budget plan to Dems, because there's things they don't like in it. They don't like the cuts. They don't like some of the taxes. They'd rather have other taxes. And the governor never made that pitch because he has been...
with the Navy SEALs in Abbottabad.
Exactly.
No?
No. No one knew that. But, you know, he can do some pull-ups. Well, I mean, you know.
We're breaking that news.
He got up the compound, and there he went. And the governor underwent a procedure to remove a cancerous place off of his nose, a basal cell carcinoma off his nose, which is generally considered to be a low-grade form of skin cancer. Mm-hmm. And has been recovering because he had some kind of reconstructive surgery. They haven't told us a whole lot about that, but my assumption is that the stitches look pretty gnarly.
And
doesn't
they don't
be
play
out
well
public.
On TV.
Yeah, exactly. He doesn't want to be out on TV doing it. You, however, had to do more than just make that mention this week, did you not? You had to be the pesky reporter to ask, why don't we know more about the governor's health? Which in complete fairness and defense of my good friend Mr. York here, is a question I think every journalist asked themselves immediately after the news came out. What did they know when? How did it get known? What should we know about a governor's health? You know, and on and on and on.
But, right. And this has to do with sort of the relationship we have with our politicians and
The public.
Yes. And the clamoring for personal details. I mean, every doctor you talk to says that this is a medically insignificant event. I mean, the fact that it was early and treated, and the governor had a procedure that actually is sort of more careful, is a sort of a bigger cut, and make sure that they cut all the cancer out. And you know, there were some questions on the timeline of what they knew when, and you know whether you know, and they waited about 8 days after the diagnosis to disclose this to the public, and until he had to cancel some public events. But, you know, if you look back from, you know, I think ever since Paul Tsongas died of cancer, you know, he was a cancer survivor running for president in 1992. He said he was cured, that he was in remission 5 years. He was basically cured. And the cancer ended up coming back, and he died in what would have been during what would have been his first term in office. Had he
John
been
McCain got a lot of flack for being an older politician with melanoma, which is a much more serious form of skin cancer.
Yeah. And so these things, while medically insignificant, politically they help, you know, burnish an image of a politician that can be politically significant. Remember, this is a governor who, during the campaign, I mean, was very aware there were going to be questions about his age and his vitality, and challenged reporters to pull up competitions and won, you know, and that sort of helped put the age issue to rest very early on. And so it's something that he's aware of. It's really more of a political issue than it is a medical issue. even as political issues go, it's not a big deal. It's just a little, you know, it's a, and it also harkened back to, I mentioned this in the story I wrote this week, about Governor Schwarzenegger. You know, Governor Schwarzenegger broke his leg in what was called a ski accident in 2006.
And over the Christmas holidays, I remember
right
the email.
Before his inaugural. Yeah. And the clear image that we were allowed to formulate for ourselves was the governor in Idaho, you know, going down a skiing,
right,
a black diamond
right,
and crashing at 50 miles an hour and breaking his leg. And they were all too happy to have us believe that. As it turned out, he was standing still and tripped over a ski pole and slid down the mountain. And that's not very Terminator-esque. And so I think, you know, politicians, whether it's Jerry Brown or Arnold Schwarzenegger, are aware of their image. I mean, in different ways and for different reasons, perhaps. But I think that that image consciousness was clear in the way the Brown administration, you know, handled this announcement, I think.
And we don't have to belabor the point much longer because I'm mindful of the stopwatch here. I'm sure the Brown people are already tired of hearing us talk about it. I think the quote at the end of your piece was, we're done talking about this story, right? From Gil Durand. So, Gil, don't worry. We're going to be done in a minute. But a couple of notes for people listening. One, Anthony and I and one other reporter from the Sacramento Bee, David Siders, were the ones who actually were there when the conversation first happened. And it was David who had said, because there was a Band-Aid on the governor's nose, Governor, what happened to your nose? And they kind of didn't quite say. And then David said, is it melanoma? No. Is it cancer? And then there was a no. And so that kind of began part of this discussion of like, you know, and that was after, apparently with the timeline you have, they knew stuff or things had gone on.
Well, it's
on.
Still unclear. It's still unclear.
Fair
enough. And the administration is not.
So we were there, and again, I think that's a relationship with the press issue. And the last thing I would say is, again, a relationship with the press issue. This administration has a very different approach to answering questions from the press, a different timeline, a different sense of urgency than Schwarzenegger or most other current chief executives and big politician and big off. It doesn't have a big press operation.
Right.
You know, and so I think that only furthers kind of the odd oddity. I mean, we've accepted that it's a different world order of press operations in the Capitol. But when something like this comes up, we're fielding a lot of questions and they don't answer them in the same way, shape, or form.
And there's not that rapid response. And look, on the day-to-day operations, this is something I was actually asked about. There was a Columbia Journalism Review piece about the Brown administration.
You
press.
And I both talked to that.
Yeah. And look, on the day-to-day, the administration can get away with not, you know, doing the sort of rapid response mode that many of us are used to because the governor's accessible, frankly. I mean, he's a lot more accessible than any other governor I've covered. In some ways,
but I'll get to that. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, at least if you have a question, you can flag him in the halls, usually. This was an instance where the governor was not available, and the administration was not answering detailed questions about it. And so it is one of those it's an indication, and it'll be interesting again. You know, we will be tested again as we come up against the May revise and these big news events when we're all clamoring for details, you know, on issues that, you know, when there's a big news event again, you know, that's when some of the understaffing of the press office sort of shows and I think frustrates some reporters who cover the administration.
Well, and interestingly enough, you know, and again, we wish the governor well and speedy recovery, and everyone does, but I can't help but wondering whether the cosmetic recovery will remind me of Governor Schwarzenegger's budget event where he came out with the busted lip. Do you remember that?
After the motorcycle.
Because they crashed the motorcycle. Right. Yeah, and anyway. And then people started asking about his lip, and then he didn't have a driver's license. But we digress. But the only other thing I was going to say about the governor's press operation is we all kind of knew this, but if you haven't read it yet, it came out on Thursday. The long-awaited New York Times huge profile. One Republican called it a good wet kiss for the governor, a nice they didn't think it was very critical, of Jerry Brown in the New York Times Magazine by Adam Nagorny, longtime political writer based in Southern California now. And the bit that I loved was that watching Jerry proofread, copy edit his own press releases, at least in one case, and spent a lot of time on it.
Yeah.
And we've all kind of long thought that was part of the Brown press operation mentality of the governor is that I'm the spokesman for me. I'm the guy, you know, and so I'm going to be checking that stuff. And so that little anecdote in the article kind of proved that.
Yep. And he likes Brussels sprouts.
He does. And the article, now transitioning to more weighty, important things, the article, again, also kind of reconfirmed, I think, with a very great quote about that there was no plan B.
Yeah.
Jerry Brown's budget, you know, and referred
Cortez.
To the to Cortez. Cortez storming the beach and burning the ships.
Yes.
Burn the ships. We've, you know, and again, the reference being, I didn't go in this with an assumption to fail. I went in with an assumption to work.
Well, and although we will see Plan B next Monday.
We have to see some Plan B, right, on May 16th with the revised budget. I think you kind of referenced it in the article you wrote on the health issue. That has kind of dropped off the big public press media push thing that the governor had been doing, the Santa Clarita event you and I went to, other events. He isn't out there right now. And so that probably is an unexpected detour off of where he was trying to make his case for his budget.
And what's interesting is that there are no other, you know, vocal champions of the governor's proposal as drafted, you know, I mean, that are sort of stepping in and filling that void. I mean, I think next week we will see the ratcheting up again. The Assembly Democrats, Assembly Republicans are expected to unveil some kind of budget proposal.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that some details about the May revision will be trickling out inevitably, as they always do.
At the same time as we get this state of emergency capital sit-in protests kind of organized by the California teachers. Very interesting.
Teachers sleeping in the rotunda.
Yeah, well, but there's some kind of story out that Cindy Sheehan, longtime Iraq war critic and protester, is going to join them somehow. And
well, not affiliated, but she's
She's just camping out. She's just bringing a sleeping bag.
And her television camera friends. Mm. Yeah.
Something tells me we'll all have to go over there and watch to see what happens.
The clowns and the elephants will be in the on the Senate side, and then the
jugglers
on the Assembly side. Yes.
So, I mean, it's good. All of these kind of things are going to kind of be marinating around next week, and that in itself is interesting because it is the week before we actually see a budget plan out there and write some kind of Plan B from the governor. You know, back to the New York Times piece. I mean, I understand the criticism from Republicans that it wasn't critical enough, that it didn't have any. But
it was a feature.
But it was exactly. My response is it's a feature piece. It didn't break any big news, but I found it an interesting read. Found it an interesting read, and it does. I think it does capture some of Brown, of who he is, and his approach to what he's doing here, and his. And the fact that he's as comfortable in his skin as he always comes off being, I mean, he really, you know, that's shows in a lot of what he does. So.
Yeah, and I think that that's something that most of us who cover him pretty, you know, regularly would say that. I mean, that it does seem like the real guy.
I do think, though, that it's hard as a California reporter not to notice the access. And again, where there's not been that kind of access, and I referenced this a moment ago. Yes, the governor answers a question in the hallway or walking to and from a coffee shop. But if you want to try to engage him and understand where he's coming on a policy as in a sit-down interview, there hadn't been a whole lot of that.
But even I mean, but the kind of
Sure we'd get anything even then?
No. And I'm sure that you, like I, have refreshed our requests for longer form sit-down interviews.
Time. If anyone in the governor's office is listening, separately, Anthony and I, me first, Anthony second.
No, circulation order, right?
How about an audience size order?
How about alphabetical by first name?
Go ahead.
Okay.
I hadn't thought of that one.
Where was I?
We were just talking about access.
Oh, but even then, I mean, look, I've been as interested in having a longer form interview with the governor as every other reporter in this state. But again, with this profile, that's not the piece that you would do. That's not the piece that I would do. It's a very different kind of journalism, kind of reporting. I mean, we're going to be more interested in some substance, I think. And so I'm not to say that the story was not substantive, but in the news and the policy details, I mean, we're going to want to know details about budget and policy and, you know, more of that, which really wasn't the goal of the piece that Adam wrote. It just wasn't. And so, I mean, look, frankly, I think that you and I will have a lot more to talk to the governor about, and we'd probably be better served with our sit-down after this revised budget is released on the 16th.
Fair enough. Well, let's veer oh so slightly into something substantive, even though we've got to talk about the political impacts of it. So a couple of budget things to talk about. First of all, over this week, we had the big first vote on the state worker contracts that the governor negotiated. Six bargaining units. But, of course, the bargaining unit that everybody talked about was the Correctional Peace Officers Association, the prison guards.
Go ahead.
The six – so they were in the front of the state Senate, had to have a two-thirds vote to pass out of the Senate. The first vote was 26-14, only one Republican voting for the contract, Sam Blakesley from San Luis Obispo.
Who received $250,000 from CCPOA and his IE.
You always going to say benefited to that amount, not directly in his account. Yeah, IE,
Silly
fair enough.
Right.
I just want to be fair.
Right.
And then we had a delay, a little bit more lobbying going on.
Until
one more Republican, Anthony Cannella, senator.
Who received $300,000. From CCPOA
in assistance via independent expenditures for his campaign.
There's any connection.
Freshman senator from Ceres, from the Central Valley, flipped his vote, switched it from a no to a yes.
And really, was he ever
27 votes?
Right.
And so now they go to the assembly. Still got to have a two-thirds vote. But you know, again, this is another great story of the Correctional Officers Union. They are very good at spreading the money out. Dems, REAPs. You know, and you look at the numbers, because I went back to look at some of their stuff that day, campaign finance reports, and look at the number of Republican legislators who have gotten financial assistance from the CCPOA as well.
Yeah.
So they're good at that game. And this is the first contract they've had in a long time. It was interesting, though, back in the Senate, several big supporters of the guards in the past did not give them a vote. Bob Dutton, Republican leader in the Senate. Others, I mean.
And yet
they got what they needed.
So. I mean,
so I should just give it up.
Well, no. I mean, look, last year, for all the pension issue and the contract issue now has come to the fore. And so last year there was legislation on the floor of the Senate, and it was talking about, furlough legislation and savings from state worker contracts. And a number of Republicans, including Mr. Blakesley and Senator Dutton, got up and voted against the legislation because they didn't want the prison guards to be impacted by it. I mean, this was a no vote because of the way it would have adversely affected the prison guards. And
did
so,
they vote no or do they just not vote?
I can't remember if there were
abstentions. I thought there was a layoff and then they had to make the bill a majority vote bill.
Maybe. Whatever it was. They didn't vote for it.
I just don't
want
to.
And Dutton spoke against it. I think Dutton spoke against it on the floor. Am I wrong about that? I can't remember. Anyway.
I'm sure someone will call us.
Point being that there was some support for CCPOA from some Republican corners, but now the issue has morphed a little bit. Number one, there's a Democrat in the legislature, and I think that or in the governor's office, and that some Republicans are very eager to damage Jerry Brown politically, and so they see this opportunity, the Prison Guards Union,
to let us connect the dots of the money was spent to help get Brown elected by the union,
right.
And stories, including a very good one out of your paper, the LA Times, that raise questions about the provisions of the contract that allow them to get more money or help them out or favorable to them.
Right.
And the fact that none of the contracts save as much money as the governor originally projected they were going to save.
Right.
So, yeah, it plays into the narrative is what
right.
you're saying.
And so I think that there are clearly political motivations. At the same time, you know, Dutton can cast a no vote in part because Blakesley and Cannella cast their yes votes. And so there may be an element of political cover here as well. Fair? Is that speculative?
It's all speculative, such as the podcast. I do want to talk on the issue of the savings that back to, you know, when I asked the governor about it when we were at that event before he was out of public sight, was not an answer I expected. And he said it to George Skelton, too, who wrote it in a column recently. The governor said, that's not really a real number that we put in there. Effectively, he didn't say that's not a direct quote, but he effectively said, no one should have expected I was going to get that savings. That was before we negotiated. Well, yes, but it also means you've got to find some other numbers.
Right.
And again, it gets back, not completely, but I do think there is a danger for the governor there of getting back to his pledge to do honest budgeting.
Well, and
I
clearly,
mean, in a way, I mean, that's the, you know, if you put that number in there and people are assuming that's going to be part of the savings and protecting something else or not doing something else and you don't get it, I mean, it was what, $300 million or so off?
Yeah. Well, and presumably when this revised budget is released on May 16th, the diminished savings will be reflected in this revised budget. And so I mean, look, the governor has some leeway to say, hey, look, this was a negotiating position because, you know, this is – we didn't want to put our true bottom line in the budget because then they would have ratcheted us down from that, right? That's just how negotiations work. And so now here we are. It's really May that you pay attention to. That is – I think the blueprint of the governor's budget will remain largely intact on May 16th. There'll be some tweaks. The new revenues that we discussed, and then on the cost side, as we saw the director of finance say in a statement today, including these contracts, there'll be some tweaks on the cost side as well.
And so, yeah, the revenues was we've alluded to somewhere on the magnitude of $2.5 billion or so better by the time we get to May.
In this, right? Well, see,
not all of it came from April, but April was better than expected.
Right.
If you look at income taxes, sales taxes, we got that data from the Ledge Analyst Office on Thursday. You're somewhere in the $2.5 billion category. But again, the governor's budget director, Ana Matasantos, issued some statement today that says don't count that yet for various reasons.
Right.
That you've pointed out some and others to not assume that we are automatically $2.5 billion better.
And some people's calculations would assume that we're actually more like $4.5 to $5 billion better because it's collections in the current year.
Oh, and then you assume that revenue would remain constant. That's the new marker.
Right.
Which, in other words, then it's not a one-time thing. It's the economy coming back. Pop the champagne corks.
Right.
Well, we will see.
We'll find out.
This governor's been conservative on numbers other than that contract thing, I think, in other ways. I mean, because he didn't even count some of the better scoring earlier.
There's a political dimension, too, that we mentioned when we podcasted briefly from Santa Clarita, is that there's a political problem with the economy improving for the governor. The governor still wants new taxes or, well, yes, I guess, additional tax revenue.
You wanted to say new because we've passed the deadline, but then there would be some way to,
Right, anyway, wants taxes.
Additional tax dollars.
As part of this budget, and if the economy is improving, and he wants voters to ratify these taxes, and if the economy is improving, I mean, voters might say, we already saw the Assembly Republican leader Connie Conway this week saying, hey, look, the revenues are getting better. It looks like we don't need taxes. So there's a problem for sort of the linchpin of Brown's budget plan if the economy improves just enough to take the edge off, but not enough to really solve the problem.
So then let's talk quickly about the other thing that was budget-related. I think this is probably the only other thing for now that happened this week, and that was moving forward on this bill by Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg, which is a fascinating bill.
Absolutely.
Because it has a tremendous political leverage point out there. And this is the bill that would say local communities, and by local, I mean, you really mean local, not only counties and cities, but school districts could, if 2/3 of the voters in their area agree, could impose their own income taxes, their own car taxes, their own oil extraction taxes.
Not two-thirds if it's for a specific purpose, simple majority if it's a general fund tax.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean that's the law.
But if you're a school district, it's got to be for a specific purpose of schools.
I don't know the idea of school districts levying income taxes.
We will let the lawyers parse this. Okay, fair enough. I will amend my statement to say that maybe there's some discussion about the tax threshold, but the voters would have to ratify it in some way, shape, or form. But the bigger picture is that it would allow effectively communities to fix their own government service shortfalls, their budget shortfalls that the state would impose, thereby going around Republicans who may not ever vote for taxes.
Right.
So if you're in the Bay Area, you agree to it. If you're a school district in Concord, you may agree to it. Fresno won't get it. Madera County won't get it. And we could go on and on.
And you could talk about the potential impacts of this, not only on, but, you know, whether we have these sort of balkanized counties. And there's, you know, some precedent for this. I mean, this was an issue with schools. The famous Bakke decision, the California Supreme Court decision that said essentially, you know, you had schools used to be funded primarily with property tax
Serrano.
I'm sorry, yes. Bakke is.
Bakke was the university.
That's the university.
Right, I'm right,
mixing
the,
my,
right, the Serrano.
That's U.S. Supreme Court. Anyway.
Serrano
decision.
Yes.
Thank you for that one. But that school districts were funded from local property tax revenues, and so areas that had higher property taxes had more resources for their schools. The courts ultimately said, you can't do that. That's not, you know, that ain't right. And so, but what's interesting about this bill, the Steinberg bill, this SB 653, which is kind of the slow-moving nuclear bomb, you know, as it trudges through the budget process here.
Sounds like a James Bond movie.
Like, it's just like tick, 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 right? Mm-hmm. Is a couple of things. Number one, you wonder where the governor is on this, because this whole talk about realignment, I mean, from his campaign, moving government closer to the people, this seems to fit in there. And so is this something that's being done in coordination with the administration and, you know.
And it's a majority vote bill.
Right. That's another piece. It's a majority vote bill. And the other piece is kind of the poetic nature of this. When you think about Brown, Brown was governor in 1978 when voters passed Prop 13. Prop 13 froze property tax levels effectively and ended up inadvertently centralizing a lot of decisions about local government because with the property taxes frozen, you had to go to Sacramento where they could raise sales and income taxes and then backfill those revenues back. I mean, right now, more than 70% of the state budget is a simple pass-through to schools, cities, and counties. Now, this would somehow, the property taxes would remain frozen, but you would give these local governments all this new taxing authority. It's not just sales, but if you read the bill, it's sales and...
What's alcohol taxes?
Well, it's
It's not sales
it's goods
taxes,
and services.
It's excise taxes.
It's goods and services, which is there's been a lot of discussion as the economy has transformed from a manufacturing economy to a service economy, whether we should be taxing things like tech support and other services that are currently not taxed. All the sin taxes, alcohol, tobacco, oil extraction, soda or sweetened beverages, you know.
Wine coolers.
Sorry, that's a double whammy because it's sweetened and it's alcoholic.
If we hadn't banned those loco 40s. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
go ahead,
exactly.
Please.
But it would fundamentally alter California government. And I do think, I mean,
that's assuming the voters would pass them. But there are communities where you know
some communities they would.
Where you know voters would, and conversely, there are communities we know voters would not.
It does raise this question, though, and let me just throw this out here. If this thing does pass, and I think Democrats are considering this as an option if Republicans won't agree to more revenues in some way, shape, or form. If this does pass, and all these major decisions then are essentially taken out of Sacramento and returned to the locals, at what point do voters start looking at Sacramento and thinking, well, okay, what do you guys do? Why do we need a full-time legislature?
Yeah.
I mean, really, is that not another possible fallout from this? Now,
but that's assuming that someone—
and that's a long way.
Yeah, that's
a lot of
hypotheticals. Several chess moves away, and it's also assuming that it is, in fact, and with due respect to the pro tem, that it is a fully driven by policy needs and not just the political thing to use as leverage. And
right.
Again, respect to the pro tem. I'm sure he believes in part, but he knows too there's a political advantage.
Clearly, this is.
Well, and the other thing I was going to mention too is that it is, to me, it is the yin to the yang of the Bill Lockyer comment from the other week.
Right.
You know, Bill Lockyer, the state treasurer, said to some Bay Area reporters, you know, let's do the cuts in Republican districts if the Republicans won't vote for the taxes. And it got them all in my favorite podcast word, a kerfuffle.
Kerfuffle.
Got a whole bunch of kerfuffle from Republicans
there.
I think
you're in a tizzy, but the incident may have caused a kerfuffle.
Good. I like that.
Yes.
I like that clarification.
Okay.
But, you know, this, however, comes at the same issue from a different end. Not necessarily cutting someone versus someone else, but someone else has more tax dollars and someone else then has to rely on the state, which doesn't have any money.
Right.
So it's a more artful way almost kind of getting at it, of saying, look, we're not going to hurt you. Somebody else just gets more help.
Well, another sort of wonky insidery thing just to consider as this bill moves. This bill is a Senate bill. The deadline for passing bills out of the House of Origin is in early June. I think it's June 3rd, if I'm not mistaken. That's, you know, that's a couple of weeks before the deadline to pass a budget. Now, there's a sense, you know, a lot of business groups are mobilizing against this bill. We saw Californians for Higher Taxes, or against higher taxes, excuse me. Californians Against Higher Taxes send out some press releases.
Well, if you looked at the opposition on the bill analysis, I mean, it was every business
group
in the state.
The laundry list.
Yeah.
But politically, they figured the best chance of killing this bill would be on the Senate floor. Right, that's the place, because there's so many moderate Democrats there. That might be, that is kind of the last leverage point for the business community to try to kill this bill. And so if there's no deal in place by early June, I think there's some concern that it would be difficult for the business community to hold the line and keep all the mods off of this bill.
Because couldn't you gut and amend it, though, into a bill and jump the House anyway, the whole House of Origin? I mean, you could just gut and amend into a Senate bill that was already in the Assembly?
Well, you could, but if you wanted to move it, I mean, Steinberg could push it before the deadline, and then if there, you know, if he has the votes to get it out, and the pro tem has had some problems getting his bills out of his own House.
Of course, 21's a lot better than having all 25 of your members. But still, point taken.
But it's the last leverage point, because once that bill's over in the Assembly, it'll sail out. And if it's not amended, then it doesn't have to go back to the Senate at all. So anyway, again, real wonky, lots of hypotheticals. But for those game theorists who are into this stuff, it's something to watch.
It's a good marker to... to think about there.
See how big of a budget nerd you are, if you're still listening.
Yeah, that's debatable. We've gone through it. But hey, there wasn't a podcast last week,
so this one's going double.
It's kind of a twofer.
That's right.
It's kind of like, you know, when you buy those little packages at Costco and you get another toothbrush. But I
the
digress.
One you never use.
Yeah.
You give that one to the cat.
It's actually the one that my 19-month-old finds and then starts dipping in the toilet. But, you know, I digress. Well, you'll be there soon enough.
Soon enough. 14
Daddy-o.
Months.
And with that, we'll take our kid talk off mic. That's Anthony York from the LA Times. I'm John Myers from KQED. Sorry we missed you last week, but thanks
My
for
bad.
Listening.